You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, October 21st. My pleasure to be with you, and hope you're doing well. Hope you're looking forward to a good weekend. We'll see if we can get it kicked off right, that you may, your employer may still insist on you coming to work today. I know. It's a cruel world. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to be on the program at all today. 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. My guest this hour coming up in the next segment will be Nancy Jo Sales. She's been on the program before, a journalist, an author, actually a New York Times best-selling author. Recently wrote the book about the social habits of American teenage girls called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers, which was an investigation into how social media has changed the lives of girls and presented them with unprecedented challenges. But we'll be talking specifically about a piece that she wrote for Vanity Fair, actually a couple of pieces, one that she wrote a couple of years ago, really taking issue with the online dating apps like Tinder and Hinge, which she says have helped bring about what she calls a dating apocalypse, in that they have taken the hookup culture, which was already had its wheels turning, and just simply hit the accelerator, because through these types of online apps, and again, not something I'm familiar with, I'm not on the dating market, I don't even have a smartphone, the concept is simple, that you are presented with people in your area, images of these people, and you can either swipe right if you like what you see, swipe left, I guess, into the virtual dustbin if you don't. And she argued in a piece, I think a 2015 piece in Vanity Fair, that that these websites encourage a very superficial and objectifying approach to dating, and particularly with negative effects on women. So she wrote that original piece, and then in which she really got provoked some serious damage control from Tinder. This was a piece actually that came out a little over a year ago in September of 2015. Then she would read a follow-up piece about some correspondence that she'd gotten from the CEO of Hinge, which is a similar type of app, about some changes they are making because they took to heart some of the concerns, particularly the fact that women who have used these, a majority of them say they have received a really unwanted, all the very crude and demeaning sort of messages because of their involvement with these websites, over these apps, and Hinge taking the initiative to try to be a different sort of thing. So we'll follow up with her about that. And as I said, you know, I don't know that Nancy Jo is a person of faith. I'm not sure where she is on that, but she certainly provides a valuable service in terms of exposing trends in our culture that are very dehumanizing. So we'll look forward to that in the second hour. We'll also spin the Dalek Catechism wheel as we do. And as I said, my question of the day, what is your favorite song about marriage? Not wedding songs, right? I mean, every generation has their popular wedding songs. The one now probably is Thinking Out Loud, that Ed Sheeran. I'm sure that's fairly popular. Just like back when the pop song that was big when my wife and I got married, I think, was Always by, was it Atlantic Star? Is that who sang that? Anyway, I did pull up from a website here, In It for the Long Haul, 20 Kick A songs about marriage. And let's see, they've got, I'm not sure I'm familiar with all these. Do You Remember by Jack Johnson, Harvest Moon by Neil Young, Let's Stay Together, Al Green, that's pretty good. Stay With You, that's John Legend. Let's see, anniversary song by a group called the Cowboy Junkies. I'll get back to more of those a little bit later. I was leading last night. I've been doing this college young adult Bible study, small little group at our local parish, and studying the book of Genesis, which I'm subtitling The Story of Us, because it's not even just about the book itself, and it's not even just about the fact that we get a better understanding of the entire biblical story when we start in the beginning, which is how Genesis begins and what the word Genesis even refers to, right? But it also tells us something about who we are, particularly the early chapters of Genesis. We get an understanding of what Blaise Pascal called the grandeur and the misery of man, our greatness and also our brokenness, because we have within ourselves, on most days, I would say, a knowledge of both, of the deep echo within us of who we were originally made to be, the understanding that our lives are not pointless or accidents, that there's a meaning to life, even a meaning that transcends whatever meaning we may try to assign it. There's some meaning to our life. And if we believe the basic principles of Genesis, that we were willed into being by a creator who loves us, then that resonates within us, not because we have some sort of narcissistic, overinflated view of ourselves, but because of the sense we have within ourselves that we were made for something more. At the same time, we're also aware of our own weaknesses, who, like in the words of St. Paul in Romans 7, that which we would desire to do is the very thing we don't do, and the thing we know we shouldn't do, that's the thing we do. And so we deal with this constant understanding of what we were made for and yet our current situation. And so we've been in the early chapters of Genesis reflecting on that. Last night we had a little fun, though. And I talked to them about the sort of the wild and wacky in Genesis, the stuff that pops up here. And Jason Hall and I touched base on this on the show a little while ago. But these little things that pop up that have provided consternation to biblical scholars since probably, I'm sure, before the time of Christ. These little things that pop up without explanation that in many ways are hard to reconcile, and yet there's no clear answers. And that there's several of these here just after the story of Cain and Abel that grab our attention through the end of chapter 4 to the beginning of chapter 6. And the first one that pops up, of course, is in verse 17 in chapter 4, just as after we're told that Cain was evicted from the presence of the Lord to go dwell in the land of Nod east of Eden. And then it says, Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch, and he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. Now, hold on a second. Cain knew his wife. Well, who the heck's that? I mean, that's kind of the classic biblical apologetic question, isn't it? Where did Cain get his wife? I used to have this elderly man in my Methodist church who saw himself, he was in his 80s when I knew him, saw himself as a sort of skeptic, always with a gotcha sort of thing. And he'd come up to me, you tell me something, Mike, you tell me something. You tell me. I say, what, Ken? He said, you tell me, where'd Cain get his wife? So, I mean, obviously, you know, Cain, the firstborn from Adam and Eve, Abel, the secondborn. There's no mention of anybody other at this point. So who is Cain's wife? Now, there have been all sorts of speculation since before the time of Jesus on this question, and it's an unanswerable one, ultimately, right? There are those who say, who read these early chapters of Genesis strictly literally, insist that's the way they're meant to be understood, and therefore they say, well, then it must have been one of his sisters. And, you know, there weren't laws against incest yet, and the gene pool was still very, very clean, being that these were the first human persons, and therefore incest was allowable as a necessary concession to what would be needed to populate the earth. Then there are those who take the other approach, and they say, well, actually what we have here is evidence that the early chapters of Genesis are not meant to be read and understood literally. And so there probably was no historic Cain or Abel and so forth. As I've said before, I think that view is also problematic in its own way. Because there was, certainly in the Catholic understanding, an original fall, an original couple, and therefore we can't so easily dismiss it as sort of superstitious prehistoric myth, that there's some truth here. Plus, here's the reality. Even if you set aside a biblical view of creation, even if you fully embrace a materialistic understanding of evolution, most of them argue that we did have first parents, so to speak, those who finally were human persons. Well, who did those folks marry, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing that kind of keep you up at night scratching your head. That's why I said it's an unanswerable question, and we probably don't need to spend too much time dwelling on it. The other thing that we get into just a little bit later is when we go through the genealogies and the stratospheric age of many of these early Old Testament figures, particularly Methuselah, who lived to the ripe old age of 969 years. Again, usually have a battle between those who view this literally and try to argue about the purity of early DNA or environmental corruption that had not happened to a greater degree yet, and therefore human lifespans began to decrease after the flood. And then you've got those who say it's purely legendary. I'm not sure what the answer is, I'll be honest with you. Nobody knows. That's maybe a good first step. Epistemological humility, as I call it. We'll be back with Nancy Jo Sales. We're going to talk about the dating apocalypse and online apps and all the rest. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media on this Friday the 21st. Pleased to have with us via phone Nancy Jo Sales. Nancy Jo's an award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author who has written for Vanity Fair, New York, Harper's Bazaar, and many other publications. Her recent book, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers, is an investigation into how social media has changed the lives of girls and presented them with unprecedented challenges. We had her on a few months ago to talk about that very book. Today we're going to talk about a couple of pieces that she's written, one a year ago and then one recently, a follow-up piece in Vanity Fair on online dating apps, particularly apps like Tinder and Hinge that traffic in the swipe, which those seeking prospective suitors or dates kind of swipe right if they like what they see, swipe left, and We'll talk a little bit about that and maybe one change that one of these online apps is trying to make. Good morning, Nancy Jo.
Hi.
Thanks for being willing to get up early. Hope you got your coffee.
I get up early. I have a teenager who has to go to high school, so I'm up.
There you go. So when you wrote your book, American Girls, it had personal stakes, I guess.
Yes, I'm hoping that we can change this culture for all of our daughters and sons.
Well, in these recent Vanity Fair pieces, you kind of shifted from teenage girls into young adulthood. And of course, teenagers become young adults. And let's kind of go back to your original piece that caused such a stir, particularly from Tinder on Twitter. It was a piece that you wrote for Vanity Fair in September of 2015, Tinder and the Dawn of the Dating Apocalypse. As romance gets swiped from the screen, some 20-somethings aren't liking what they see. And reading the article, you weren't suggesting that Tinder invented the hookup culture. It had been in the works for a while, but this was almost like a perfect storm intersection with the technology and the spirit of the age. Talk about that just a little bit of what troubles you about these type of swiping apps.
Well, I first heard about Tinder from a teenager, actually, when I very first was doing the article that my book American Girls is based on. I was interviewing teenagers about their lives, and a teenage girl who was 16 in Los Angeles was the first person who told me about Tinder. Kids tend to adapt any kind of apps or technology first, and so right when Tinder came out in 2013, teenagers were using it. It wasn't really designed for them, although they were able to use it very easily through Facebook. And she told me that she had wanted to, I'm sorry if any of this graphic material that offends your users, but I don't know how else to talk about it. She told me that she wanted to lose her virginity. So she went on Tinder, met up with a guy at a public place, never met him before in her life, intended to lose her virginity to him, didn't wind up doing that, and they just kind of ended up making out in the showroom of a Pottery Barn.
Wow.
Kind of a crazy teenage thing to do. But the point was that at that point in 2013, it was pretty shocking to me, and I think many other people, that someone that young could just, you know, through a few taps on a phone, meet up with someone with the intention of having sex, and that was all just sort of understood by the way these things were designed. And in fact, that's what I learned as I continued to report on girls for the book, and then heard more from girls who were, you know, older, young women in college age and a little beyond, about the way that hookup culture, which had been, you know, percolating for a couple decades, had now been really accelerated by technology. And this thing of swiping, the swiping on someone's face, as you mentioned before, saying yes or no, I like this person, I don't, seem to give the whole enterprise a feeling of shopping. And the young man in my Tinder piece, my dating apps piece, excuse me, you're right, it wasn't just about Tinder, it was about dating apps as a whole. He said, you know, it's like ordering Seamless, except it's a person. Seamless is a food delivery service.
Wow.
In New York City, or maybe other places where you just order dinner. You know, so, and this is something that was widely reported. I talked to many people in three different states about dating app culture, and it was a very, you know, well-established thing, I think, among most people that I talked to, that dating app culture was just a kind of, you know, hookup culture on steroids, you know?
Yes. I in my full-time work, I work for the Catholic Diocese, and I teach a lot of marriage preparation classes for engaged couples, you know, and I always ask, you know, couples how they met. And, you know, I'm used to being told we met, you know, online, but usually it's through something like, you know, maybe it's a Catholic singles site. You know, maybe it's Match.com, any of these various ones. But I asked this one couple recently, how did you meet? And they both kind of looked at each other and paused a minute before saying, we met on Tinder. So that was a first. So I guess occasionally maybe something permanent comes from it. But you're saying that the vast majority of the time, that's not the intent. And maybe particularly maybe a predilection of some young men to use Tinder, maybe even for just purely selfish reasons.
Well, nothing's all or nothing. You know, nothing's black and white. Of course, there are people who meet on all of these apps and form lasting relationships. I mean, the apps have only really existed for a couple of years, so how lasting will they be? We don't know, and you don't know how lasting any relationship's going to be, I guess. But on the other hand, you know, here are the elements at work here. There's just tremendous availability. There's a way in which, you know, it feels like a game. They're sort of designed like games. Somebody described it to me as being like gambling, like Las Vegas. They're very addictive. And so I think it makes it harder, and this is for men and women, I think, to focus on any one person, because you have this endless stream of people just popping up in your phone, this endless stream of possibilities and potentialities. And this one doesn't work out, can just go on to the next one kind of thing. So this is, you know, according to at least one very renowned evolutionary psychologist that I talked to, this is appealing to men, at least on a really evolutionary, you know, basis. Because, you know, there are many feminists who argue with this notion, but according to evolutionary psychology, men have evolved to seek what's known as short-term mating strategies more than women, who seek more long-term mating strategies. And this is one frame in which to look at this, but if you do look at it through this frame, you can see how these apps really upset the apple cart, evolutionarily speaking, for women.
And from what I've read in your piece, I mean, and one of the frustrations that some women have expressed is that, you know, that there's it doesn't take long before they begin to get creepy solicitations, I guess you could say, through Tinder. Maybe there's an aggression there, that because of the disembodied nature of it emboldens people. I don't know, but this is a problem too, as well as you end up with married people on there who are looking for opportunities for infidelity.
Yes, well, all social media, with its, you know, physical remove and the easy access that we have, you know, has become a factor now in cheating. And even in American divorces, there's more and more citing of even Facebook in the ways in which couples break up, because, you know, maybe somebody's not so happy with somebody some evening. Maybe they've had a fight or something. Well, it's very easy to go on even Facebook, not need a dating app, and start chatting with someone that you don't really see, or even have to, like, leave the house to go see. You can just and start telling them your troubles. You know, we can all sort of imagine how that scenario happens, and probably have heard about it through friends and people we know. I mean, it's not that only men seek casual sex or only men want to have casual sex. That's not what the piece was saying. I heard from women as well that this is something that they use sometimes, young women, in that way intentionally. It's the real problem for a lot of young women that I spoke to was more what you referred to before, which was the treatment, the level of respect or courtesy or kindness that sort of seems less of a priority in a relationship that's so quick, so fast, so anonymous sometimes. And having sex with someone that you maybe really don't know all that much about, there's not a community-based awareness of your relationship, which used to work into how people treat each other, because there's accountability based on the fact that other people are aware that you're having this relationship, you know. So well before my piece came out last year, there was a lot of reports about men, in particular men, just being very vulgar and crass and aggressive and rude to women on dating apps. In fact, there were many websites devoted to this before my piece came out. There was
Nancy Jo, we're about it. We're at about time for a commercial break. Can you stick around for a few more minutes after the break?
Oh, sure.
Okay, fantastic. I'm sorry these breaks sneak up on us. We'll be back in just a minute. If you got a question or a comment for Nancy Jo Sales, New York Times bestselling author and journalist, 573-4-BREAD-4, Mike Allen Show at gmail.com. You can also send us an email. We'll be back. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're back on the Mike Allen Show, right at the bottom of the hour. If you've got a question or a comment for my guest, Nancy Jo Sales, award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author, has written for Vanity Fair, New York, Harper's Bazaar, and many other publications, including her recent book, American Girl, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. We're talking a little bit about online dating apps, particularly with those with the swipe function like Tinder and Hinge and others. If you've got a comment or a question, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Thanks for holding on during the break, Nancy Jo.
Sure. So I just wanted to finish the last thought, which is that, so this idea that's expressed in my piece that these apps were leading to a lot of sort of rude behavior on the part of young men and even older men, it wasn't really new in my piece. It had been known there were these websites devoted to it. Tinder Nightmares, I think, was one where women would just share these really aggressive, often very vulgar, suggestive messages they would get from complete strangers on apps like OkCupid. Sometimes really, really graphic stuff. Women, young women told me about waking up in the morning and having maybe several hundred messages from people because OkCupid in particular doesn't filter. And one after the next would just be, you know, crude things. So I started to think about this and think to myself, well, what does this all mean, really, that we're seeing this type of behavior on the part of men, young men on these dating apps, and really not so much women. I mean, it's really not as common. You'll rarely hear the same sort of stories from young men. Oh, I got this really disgusting message from a girl. It doesn't really happen in the same way at all. It was overwhelmingly young men. So there was no other way that I could really look at all this, I think, and I think a lot of young women in my piece could only look at this as an expression of misogyny. And it's not that dating apps invented misogyny. It's existed, unfortunately, well before that. But this technology, the physical remove, the anonymity, the easy access seemed to be a place where young men who were going to express those types of attitudes were able to do so to often complete strangers. And it was very upsetting to a lot of the young women that I spoke to.
And it almost, I mean, it's one of the sad things is because the things that I think these things happen subtly to us. It's like a fish doesn't know it's wet. It normalizes objectification, perhaps even in the minds of these young women, too. There's a subtle, a reducing of the expectation, I guess, of what they can realistically hope for in a relationship, and almost, you know, well, a settling, I guess you could say, that really denies their own dignity and what they should be able to expect in a relationship.
Normally, you just said it so eloquently. It is a normalization, absolutely, of objectification. And it's also the idea that if you do respond negatively, or if you, and I've heard this from many young women, if you do say, hey, don't say that to me, you're not supposed to treat me like that, well, then you sort of don't get it. You're not part of the culture. You're sort of unhip. I mean, this is like in the way it's judged, you're a prude. What are you, a feminist? I mean, it's sort of like they're kind of in this bind, a lot of them told me, where they feel like you really, there's really not a lot of places to maneuver, because in real life, our IRL meeting has become so much less of the way that people meet, especially in urban centers. And the dating app culture does have these problems sort of built into these platforms. And I think that partially why that is because of who's creating them. It's not like these apps grew out of the ground like an orange tree or something. They're not natural. They were created by people in a culture. And the culture is Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley tends to be this very bro culture. It's been written about extensively. It's mostly men, mostly white men. Not that there's anything wrong with being a white man, I'm not saying that, but it's just that is going to, and they're mostly young, just out of college, and a lot of them are literally frat boys. Mm. And so you have dating culture now created by frat boys is a lot what's going on. Or young men with a kind of frat boy sort of aesthetic. So it's not like this is all some sort of naturally evolved thing where, oh, well, this is just how human beings are deciding, you know, sort of collectively over thousands of years to get together. No, this is a bomb that's been dropped suddenly into the whole world of dating and mating, and it's been engineered by a certain demographic.
And that was really, you know, which will segue us really into your most recent piece, because in your original piece, I mean, that was a contention that you were making, not just a sort of hand-wringing, you know, these kids today, what does it come to, but that this sort of dating apocalypse has been partially facilitated by, and perhaps even intentionally, by these swipe-functioned apps. And it was interesting to read in this most recent piece sort of two equal and opposite reactions to your original Vanity Fair piece. One was, on the negative side, Tinder reacting very defensively, really reacting on Twitter, another social media world, against Vanity Fair and against you specifically, trying to defend themselves. But yet another one, Hinge, reacting perhaps with a greater degree of self-examination. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, this all goes back almost a year ago now. Yeah, it's a year ago after the piece came out, which was, I don't know, September of 2015. Tinder's Twitter account started tweeting at me one night, really kind of obsessively, I would say. They sent me over 30-something tweets railing against my piece, saying that it wasn't true. And it's really ironic because the piece wasn't just about Tinder. It was a little bit, I think, narcissistic on their part to assume that this whole piece was about them. It really wasn't. It was about dating app culture, of which they, of course, are sort of the king. They have, if you believe them, tens of millions of users. And by the way, getting back to the whole thing of how, which Tinder claims that people are, you know, all getting married off of Tinder, if they really have tens of millions of users and billions of swipes, as they claim, and everyone is using this to get married, then how come the marriage rate is still plummeting? I mean, it just doesn't track statistically. So anyway, they were tweeting at me this, that Tinder was used for people to get married and to fall in love, and it was just all this really wonderful thing, and I didn't get it, and what was I talking about? And, you know, so they tweeted at me, and I really tried not to engage and respond, but the fact of it's unusual for a corporate entity to do that to a person, especially a journalist, to tweet so crazily, especially in the middle of the night, so like Donald Trump style. So it became kind of a news story, and it was picked up everywhere, and they were kind of made fun of for doing it just because it seemed like a lack of control on their part. And as you say, defensive. And I don't know if it was as a direct result of this. I have no idea. But actually, their CEO was changed very shortly after that, within days.
Wow.
So, so that was kind of crazy. The piece also got a lot of resistance from people in the media who would, you know, sort of trot out these young women to say, you know, I love Tinder, and I love having casual sex, and it's really just great. And so, I mean, maybe they actually sincerely felt that, but I did feel that there was this kind of also media resistance. I think it's like you say, fish doesn't know it's wet, frog doesn't know it's boiling in the pot. It's very hard. Since I've been writing about technology for the last, and its impact on culture, particularly impact on sex, I've learned that people are very resistant to the idea of change. They're very resistant to the idea that we are experiencing any kind of change. I don't know why, maybe because it's scary. And yet, we are living through an unprecedented change in our lives here. We now have technology that simply didn't exist a very short time ago. These smartphones, social media on our smartphones, our sort of continual connectedness to all of this is changing our behavior. It may even be changing our brains, but people are resistant, and I think to acknowledging this sometimes. So how this works into Hinge. Well, Hinge was a dating app which also employed the swipe, and it was one that many people I spoke to talked about using. Some guys, some sort of Wall Street finance bros, you know, talked about using Hinge also to get laid and have lots of sex with girls and all this stuff. So meanwhile, I knew nothing about this a year ago. I didn't know anything about this till August, but the CEO of Hinge is a young man, 32 years old, named Justin McLeod. He's like a Harvard Business School graduate. He wanted to make the next Match.com for his generation, started Hinge right out of business school, came out around the same time as Tinder. And really, I think sincerely, after talking to him at length, I think he sincerely wanted to create an app like Match, where people could really meet and get to know each other and have lasting relationships. And he saw
Nancy Jo, we're about out of time for this. Could you hang off for maybe just a couple minutes after the break? Would that be a possibility?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, these segments fly by when you're having fun, and really appreciate it. But if you can stand up for a few more minutes after the break, that would be great.
It's a sort of complicated story.
No, absolutely. It's great. It's great stuff. I'm just thankful for whatever time we can get. So we'll be back in just a minute more with Nancy Jo Sales, best-selling author and journalist and cultural commenter. We'll be back in just a minute. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
It's before the hour. You're back on The Mike Allen Show. Hope you got big weekend plans here on this Friday the 21st. Blessed to still have via New York with us on the phone, Nancy Jo Sales, award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author. She's written for Vanity Fair, New York, Harper's Bazaar, and other publications. And her most recent book is American Girl, Social Media, and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. We're talking about swiping apps, which by and large young adults peruse in, and the different reactions she got to a piece she wrote in Vanity Fair a year ago, from, on the one hand, Tinder, very defensive, Hinge, on the other hand, a rare display of corporate responsibility. Well, before we get back into it, Nancy, let me just say one of the reasons I appreciate your work is, you know, I'm a Catholic person in the media, and I have a Catholic show, but you know, when I critique the culture, or when others like me critique the culture, many in the secular world kind of reject it as just sort of, you know, these are uptight religious people who don't get it. And, you know, they have some sort of puritanistic, you know, motivation behind, you know, some sort of finger wagging. To hear it from someone who travels and writes in the secular world, and to say there are plenty of, non-explicitly religious reasons to be troubled by what's going on, I think you have an important voice.
Thank you very much. And I have to tell you, this is not based on like one or two interviews. This is over now going on years. I mean, I started all this work on social media and reporting on kids and young people and social media more than 3 years ago. So we're going on almost 4 years of talking to literally hundreds of sources. So it's not as if it just springs from some agenda on my part at all. In fact, a lot of things about my reporting, if you had asked me, 4 years ago, what do you think of pornography, for example, I'm sure I would not have had an opinion. I didn't really think about porn or have much of an opinion about it. But after seeing, for example, how it affects the lives of kids and how they are so exposed to it via their phones and social media and so forth, I've come to really realize how damaging it is to them. And I've gotten some of that resistance, particularly from the media too. And I've gotten very good reviews of my book, and I've gotten some really snarky reviews. And in those reviews, sometimes there's that same attitude that, oh, this is puritanistic and it's a moral panic and so forth. But these are not people who have actually seen what is going on in high schools and even middle schools when you have really children who, by our very laws, are not allowed to watch porn, watching it, being affected by it, having it affect their sense of, if it's girls, self-esteem and well-being. I mean, it's unfortunate that there are these prejudices and these sort of, you know, political agendas about, you know, what to think and how to think and this kind of identity politics where people say, well, I can't be against porn because then that makes me a right-wing Christian or something. Not true. I am Jewish. I'm grew up in an extremely liberal household, and yet I'm also a parent. I'm a mother, and I care about, you know, the future and how people are going to treat each other. And in not just in the future, but right now, every day. And I see this social media culture and dating app culture in particular filled with a kind of sometimes even cruelty, you know. And you don't have to be Christian or Catholic to object to that. You shouldn't be. You should just be human. So that's my spiel on that.
And a lot, you know, and as you said, we're so, you know, you talk about it's going younger and younger. I was telling you off air, you know, my 11-year-old is one of only a couple of girls in her whole class who don't have a smartphone. And as you said, by and large, many of these are not being monitored because the parents were buried in our own online world. And so, you know, there's so much going on, and it's just harder than the investment that we want to make to be aware of that.
We have to get the corporate, we have to get some corporate responsibility going on the part of Silicon Valley. And that's really a key element to making things better. And that's why it was so encouraging, actually, to get this email in August from the CEO of Hinge, who I mentioned is this young man, Justin McLeod. And he said, hey, I just wanted you to know that we have completely redesigned our app and are relaunching in October, which they just did last week, based on your piece on dating apps. Because what they did was, he already knew, and I can't believe that other corporate, you know, dating apps don't know from their own internal research. He already knew from what they were doing when they were researching at Hinge that across the board, men and women were unsatisfied, very dissatisfied with this dating app culture for a number of reasons. He already knew that. He didn't exactly know why. So what they did was they sent out, after my piece came out, they said, well, is this true? I mean, is what she's saying really true? So they sent out surveys to their users, 500,000 users.
Wow.
And these were, you know, multiple surveys and asking many questions, and came back with a real validation of the reporting that I had done, including the fact that women were receiving these kind of harassing, sometimes even threatening messages, crude language. And
7 in 10 yeah. surveyed women. Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot. Also, just this sort of callous behavior, like people, usually men, using dating apps while they're on a date with someone from the dating app. That just plays into what we were saying about the addictive nature of it and the, you know, constant access of feeling like there's somebody better. People were not forming real lasting relationships off these apps. That's the number one finding that they had. It's like, I don't remember the figure, but it was very high number of people were saying that they were never having a lasting relationship off of these apps. And McLeod said to me, I think the most, when I talked to him about it, I did a little piece for VanityFair.com about their relaunching their app. The most striking thing that he said to me is that, you know, these dating apps are kind of designed to keep you single. And he said he confronted that in his own role as CEO of this company. He said, you know, that's not a good faith proposition there, and that's not something that I want our company to represent. So they redesigned. One of the things that they did was get rid of the swipe, because he felt that that really played into this whole, you know, kind of callous shopping sort of aspect of dating apps. And they've redesigned to hopefully, he thinks, make it a way to get to know someone better, to, you know, establish more intimacy before sex happens and all this kind of thing. So who knows? I don't use the app, and I saw a prototype. He said that when users were given the prototype, they were more likely to engage in more conversation and so forth. Who knows if this can really be fixed, but they're trying. They're trying, and that's good.
And that kudos to you and your work, Nancy Jo, and shining a light on it, and certainly want to encourage you to keep that up, so there at least will maybe be some popular, you know, pressure placed. Again, I mean, we all are responsible for the direction of our culture, but certainly those who have much, more is expected. So, we'll see where it goes from here. We're about out of time, but I really appreciate you taking time to be with us, Nancy Jo, and would love to have you on again sometime in the near future.
Thank you for talking to me.
All right. Blessings, and blessings to your family, okay?
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. She is Nancy Jo Sales. You can go to the show's blog, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com, and you can check out the links there to her recent Vanity Fair pieces, as well as I've said, you can look up her book, American Girls, Social Media, and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. All right, let's spin up the Dollar Catechism wheel. We're at that point of the program where we go to random.org, our random number generator, and we spin up a number between 1 and 2,865 in this great repository of the Catholic faith. Even though we know truth is never random, it's always integrated within the panoramic totality of the truth. So 2530 is the paragraph. Let's see what Providence has in store for us. Interestingly, this is in a... Wow. How about that for... coinkydink, or we'll say Providence. This is under the section, The Battle for Purity, in the third pillar of the Catechism, the third section on the moral life. 2530, the struggle against carnal lust involves purifying the heart and practicing temperance. This is where we have to, people like Nancy Jo Sales and others shining a light on, helping us understand that, you know, lust is more than just the stereotyped, you know, peeping Tom or the old man creeper in the trench coat leering at women. Lust is anytime we objectify another person. It's when we reduce the other person simply to a commodity, shopping, so forth. And we do that in a lot of ways. We all can be guilty of it, and certainly through some of the technology out there, it facilitates that. But it involves purifying the heart, not just our eyes, but how we consider another person as a total person, who is to be loved for their own sake, not simply for what they do for us, and practicing temperance. We talked about earlier that haunting verse from Genesis, God speaking to Cain, sin's desire is for you, it's crouching at the door, but you must master it. Anyway, so a great, interesting connection there in the paragraph that we read. Hope you have a great weekend. I'll be back with you Monday by God's grace, and we'll have Jason Hall on the program. Couple topics we dig into, but that's par for the course. Thanks to Nancy Jo Sales. Thanks to Alex for running the board. We'll be back Monday. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.